What's up, Bucketheads? Anna here to tell you about another bucket list worthy baseball adventure we're hosting this summer. Together, Baseball Bucket List and Simply a Fan are taking a group to Fenway Park in Boston on June 8th to see the Savannah Bananas play at one of the most historic venues in the country. We're still working on finalizing the details, but if you want to be the first to know when ticket packages go on sale, you can sign up for our free no-obligation interest list at baseballbucketlist.com/Boston. That's baseballbucketlist.com/Boston. I can't wait to see you at the ballpark.
Major League Baseball owned the Nationals at that time in 05. Did a wonderful job recreating a perfect pregame ceremony that brought back a dozen or so one-time Washington Senators, introducing them one by one onto the field. Some of them weren't getting around so well as I used to, but Mickey Vernon and Eddie Brinkman and Joe Rosenda and Dick Bosman, it was on and on. And they saved Frank Howard for last. And the stadium shook. And I'm sobbing. Adults were crying everywhere. It was really a big, powerful, emotional night for the city. I don't know that you could ever replicate that.
What's up, Bucketheads? Thanks for tuning in, and welcome to episode number 144 of the Baseball Bucket List Podcast. I'm your host, Anna DiTommaso, and each week on the show, I speak with a different baseball fan about their favorite memories, what's left on their baseball bucket list, and what the game of baseball means to them. This week, I got to chat with Michael Ortman, who now lives in Florida but grew up in the D.C. area as a fan of the Washington Senators. Michael has a unique story and a claim to fame that I think few can make. Over the course of 50 years between 1970 and 2019, Michael never missed a single opening day. Despite his beloved Senators relocating to Texas and the D.C. area not having a team for 33 years, he found a way to get to opening day each year, a feat that is covered in his book, Opening Day 50 for 50. The 50 opening days covered 3 cities, 6 stadiums, and 5 different home teams. We learn how the tradition started with Michael's dad springing him out of school early in 1970, and how it continued while Michael was in college and began his career. Throughout the changes of life, there was always baseball and always opening day. Michael and I discussed the book, including some of his favorite stories and what it felt like to learn that baseball was coming back to DC after several decades away. Now, you may be remembering the unlikely champions of the 2019 season, and you might be connecting the dots that 2019 was also the 50th year for Michael's opening day streak. All I can say is that the epilogue of this book, which we hear about in this interview, is incredibly fitting for this story. This one was a ton of fun. I so enjoyed chatting with Michael. I know you guys are going to love the interview, so let's get right to it. Now, without further ado, sit back, relax, and enjoy some baseball banter with Michael Ortman. Michael, thank you so much for joining us today on the Baseball Bucket List. How are things in beautiful Florida?
Absolutely wonderful. Great place to be when it's cold and snowy and messy up north. So I like to be here this time of year.
Yeah. And I know this episode's not going to come out until opening day. At least that's the plan. But as we're speaking, I am fresh back home in Dallas, Texas, where it is already, you know, reaching up into the 90s, and just spent a week in Florida. And man, I miss it already. Like every time I leave, I just wonder, like, why don't I live here anymore?
Well, you know, opening day baseball season often has wonderful weather, but I went to many, many, many that it was in the 30s and rainy and cold and miserable. But by gosh, they got the game in, right?
Yeah, exactly. You have to. It's the first one. You have to.
Right.
So we're going to get into all of that, and we can reminisce over Florida, but I know that that's not where you spent a big chunk of your life. And so, you know, the first question I'm going to ask right out of the gate is, how is it that you kind of fell in love with this beautiful game of baseball?
You know, the first game I remember going to was on my birthday, my ninth birthday, in August of 1969, RFK Stadium, and my Washington Senators were playing the Seattle Pilots. And Jim Boughton was pitching for the Pilots. The Pilots only lasted a year or two. But Frank Howard hit a home run that day that just mesmerized this little boy. It was autograph day. In fact, on the book's website, I have a picture of me trying to get somebody's autograph. A lot of debate about who it was. We think it was Tim Cullen. But and when you have memories like that of days like that and listening to the games on the radio, which is what we did in the 60s and 70s, all the time. There were no home games on television. There were only a few road games on television. And that connection you had with the radio under your pillow at night, listening to the volume down low so mom and dad didn't know you were doing it, that's how we fell in love with the game of baseball.
The Washington Senators and the Seattle Pilots, I mean, you know, two teams that aren't around anymore in their original kind of, I guess, variation. Obviously, the Senators are now down here in the Arlington area.
I was about halfway through the book, I realized, you know, six cities got baseball teams after I lost mine.
Yeah.
You know, Bud Selig saw to it that his city got a team when he bought the Seattle Pilots and moved to Milwaukee. When is Bud Selig going to see to getting a team back in my city? And it was a long odyssey for 33 empty seasons, but we finally got baseball back in, in 2005.
The poor Montreal Expos make their way from the Great North back down to the U.S. here.
And of course, you mentioned the Rangers, who used to be the Senators. That was the second time D.C. lost a baseball team. The Minnesota Twins used to also be the Washington Senators. They left around 1960. So two times baseball said no more, and we had to wait a long time to get it back.
So I guess we're glad that they're no longer named the Washington Senators, and we'll maybe the Nationals will have a little more staying power.
They were never going to do that again. It was a great debate at the time that the Expos moved to Washington. What are you going to call them? And some people wanted them to be the Senators, but a number of elected officials said, look, the nation's capital does not have representation in the United States Senate. So why are we naming our team after a body we are not in? So thus came the name Nationals. Then you also know years and years earlier, decades earlier, it was the Washington National Senators was the name of the team. You harken back and talk a little bit about in the book. They were the Washington Nationals years and years earlier.
You mentioned a couple of times the book, which I know is one of the primary reasons we're here, because it just perfectly encapsulates not only your passion for the game, but your own unique history with this thing that, you know, we and anybody listening to this show right now just absolutely adore. And you're talking about 50 for 50, which is the book that you put out just after the pandemic. It sounds like, you know, based on when the introduction was written, I should say you put it together just after the pandemic, chronicling 50 opening days. You've never missed one in your life.
Until the pandemic.
Right. Yeah. Well, we all missed them, unfortunately.
Yeah. We all did, right?
Yeah. Yep. So three cities, five teams, and six different stadiums. You know, we touched a little bit on the Senators moving. Before I get too far into that, kind of give listeners an overview as to what this book is about.
Yeah. So as you mentioned, it was my pandemic project. I took the time, I took 4 hours a day of commute time out of my life and spent it finally getting around to writing the book that people kept saying, you ought to write a book. You ought to write a book. You ought to write a book. Yeah, yeah, I went every year and there were a bunch of great stories around many of those. And so I sat down to kind of put together 50 stories. One friend recently wrote a review of the book. He said, each game really is a pretext for a story that may be about the game, but rarely is it about the game. I just take something about the game and turn it into a story about baseball that was relevant to that day or that player or something about the game. So try to preserve a little of the history of the game for younger fans that don't remember that complete games used to be normal or don't remember when I was writing it, we hadn't had a strike or a lockout in 25 years. What do you mean strikes and lockouts? Players would never do that now. Well, they did, but nonetheless, I was able to chronicle that in the book as well. Only did the DH arrive and what about the steroid era? Those kinds of things fill in the blanks, right? And have a personal story to share.
I think this is such a unique idea because, you know, my favorite thing about it is that when you were nice enough to send me a copy of it in the mail and I got to kind of leaf through it, I didn't start reading it from cover to cover because it's not created in such a way that you have to, right?
Right.
I would flip to the index and I would look up, you know, some of my favorite players, like Rafael Palmeiro was my guy when I was a kid. I loved watching him play first base for the Rangers. And there were several years that mentioned Rafi. You could look up teams. So if you're a team of the Tampa Bay Rays, Devil Rays, or things like that, you could look up things in relation to that. Or, you know, 2008 was a great year for me. So I wanted to see what opening day for you was like in 2008. And I think that the fact that the book is kind of laid out that way is so unique because it does tell the overarching story of you, your relationship with baseball, baseball's history kind of as it unfolds over half a century, but also each chapter is its own snippet that you can read, you know, one here, one there. I just thought that was so clever.
That was my original intent, was to create a baseball storybook that you could read anywhere, be a chicken soup for the baseball soul kind of thing. But you read it however you want. And I even spent a few extra dollars to put, and you just mentioned it, an index in the back of the book, which you don't see too much anymore.
Right.
I did that because one of my editors looked at it and said, you know, this book is very dense. It's got so much stuff in it. And she was right. And there are names of people or places, 700 different people or places or teams in the book. So yeah, I've heard that a lot, that the index is a real helpful way for people to jump around. However, that was my intent. And it's a very personal story. I got about halfway through, an opening day 1999 in Baltimore, the Tampa Bay Devil Rays were in Baltimore. And I kind of snapped and I realized, here we go again, another expansion team in baseball, and Washington, D.C. still doesn't have a team.
Yeah.
And I realized this book is not just the stories that I can share, but it was also the story of a little boy who lost the thing he loved the most in life, his Major League Baseball team, when I was only 11 years old. And I'd done a lot of wandering around and finding a team here and falling in love for a little while, and then got into the business for a little while, fell in love with another team, but it wasn't the same. I wanted baseball back in Washington. And so the fact that the book goes all the way through 2019, when the Washington Nationals win the World Series, made a perfect epilogue for that 50-year journey. So yeah, stories are nice, but it's also part memoir of that journey that I went through.
I can imagine it would be pretty tough to stomach, again, a handful of expansion teams as DC is still just kind of sitting there going, hey, you know, remember us, we're still here. I want to back up and just kind of touch on the overall premise of this. I guess not even the book, but just this idea of going to every opening day for 50 years. I mean, it starts with your dad kind of springing you out of school, which is the greatest story ever told to any kid. You know, everybody's kind of got their own version of that memory, and it's so relatable and just quintessential Americana, I think. But I mean, how do you go from, okay, I'm 7 years old, I want to see the Senators play, to I'm going to do this for the next 49 years? I mean, when did it become kind of like a conscious decision?
Yeah, the first 15 or 20 years, there were many times it shouldn't have continued, not the least of which was 1972, when I didn't even have a team.
Yeah.
And Dad said, let's go to opening day. And keep in mind, my dad was not a baseball guy. He was a big event guy. I mean, whenever, you know, you grew up in Washington, D.C., presidential inaugural is a big deal, the parade and so forth. That's was more his cup of tea. And the fact that the president of the United States was often at opening day, made opening day that kind of thing. Mm. But then we get to 72, and this is the first baseball strike, delays opening day to a Sunday, and it happens to be convenient. Dad says something like, you know, let's go to opening day. And I thought he was kidding, because my team was now in Texas, and Baltimore, and I said, where's that? And off we went. And I was not an Oriole fan, but I went, and I don't have a whole lot of vivid memories of those years in the 70s when we went, but we went every year because Dad wanted to go. Off college, Chicago filled the void. Got to college, again, no team anywhere nearby, but my best friend had the two things that were the most important things in life: a love for baseball and a car. So off to Comiskey Park we went, fell in love with the White Sox, did that stint. And then by the time I get back to the D.C. area, I start to work in the business a little bit. So now opening day became work. In loving the Orioles a little bit more now. I figured that out once they started kind of co-signing my paycheck for a few years. And then it became a thing. So I didn't wake up one day as a teenager saying, wow, this is just great. But by the time I was in my 20s, opening day was in cruise control. Opening day is such a special day. It's not just another regular season game. It's
right.
Pageantry. It's sold out. It's the weather's 50-50, but you never know. But the flyover and the flag on the field, and they introduce every player and every coach and every locker room attendant, and it's different, and it's great. It's just a rite of spring.
When did you notice, or I guess did you notice, they obviously weren't doing flyovers for every opening day back in like the 70s, right? Like, when did all of that kind of fanfare start with opening day?
I didn't notice it until baseball came back to Washington in 05. I don't know that flyovers happened in Baltimore. They may have. Just I don't have a vivid memory of it. I can vividly remember opening day in 05. My wife and I and three of the kids had seats four rows from the top of RFK Stadium. I mean, all the way up there. And keep in mind, I had not been to a baseball game of any kind in that stadium in over 33 years. And we wind up near the top, and there's guys in military uniforms, and they were the spotters for the Air Force flyover. And they were, their job was to kind of coordinate the timing of the flyover. And that's how close to what we were, but that's the very first memory I have of those flyovers.
Yeah. I think it might have started around the like the post 9/11 kind of, you know, camaraderie and patriotism that kind of went on display as part of our sports fanfare. But there's nothing like a flyover. It you feel the rumbling of the jets coming before you can see them, and it just kind of gets you right in your soul. And you know, you get that very few times. You get that opening day, you get that all-star game, you get that World Series game one, perhaps, but limited options to see those.
True. And in Washington, it goes hand in hand in certain years with the president being there.
Mm-hmm.
You know, prior to the senators leaving for Texas, most years, the president of the United States, starting with William Howard Taft all the way up through Richard Nixon, the president was there throughout the first pitch, usually from the stands. In fact, it wasn't until Ronald Reagan that the president went out on the field and threw it. But the flyover, the president, the flag, it was all part of the trappings of opening day.
Yeah, very cool. One of the things I appreciate about the way the book is set up is, you know, you've got in every chapter, it's got, I guess, like the basics of a box score. You've got the teams, the score, you've got the ballpark attendance, the date, and the weather. And if you didn't read anything beyond that and you just thumbed through the book, that in and of itself is kind of this excellent representation of the gamut of baseball, right? I mean, you saw walk-off wins, you saw complete and utter blowouts, you saw beautiful, pristine, I can't believe that there could ever be a better day than this. And then you saw miserable, oh, it's snowing and we're going to delay the game type scenarios. And it so parallels kind of life in general, in a sense that you never really know what you're going to get. But, you know, any day at the ballpark is still a good day.
Right. Absolutely right. And even if it was miserable, and some of those days were memorable, you don't realize how memorable till after the fact. I mean, a lot of people create their bucket list looking forward.
Yeah.
I think this book is my bucket list looking back. Who knew on opening day 1982 that when Harry Carey defected from the White Sox to the Cubs, that this was the beginning of the Harry Carey era on WGN and all of America would get to know who he was? I was at his first game as the broadcaster at Wrigley Field for the Cubs. And it was 34 degrees and there was ice and snow and fans were throwing snowballs. It was miserable. But you remember that day because of what the weather was like. And it was a rite of passage, rite of spring.
Yeah, definitely. So in addition to those details, you did something else that's really unique and kind of fun is at the end of every chapter, there's a QR code that the reader can scan. It leads back to your website, which has links to the box score, to the play-by-play, sometimes even more information in addition to kind of what was added to the book. I mean, I guess you kind of had your hand forced in that, in a sense that you didn't want to write basically a yellow pages of a book, you know, just based on content. But how'd you come up with such a cool idea to kind of give the reader more if they want it?
You know, my brother-in-law read a couple of the chapters and he said, you know, you should put the box scores of all these games in there. And I said, okay, I get that.
Yeah.
Because it'll bring back memories. And I really could relate to that because as I was researching, this book isn't all memories. It was a lot of research of, okay, I know I was there, but I don't remember the game. And you go into baseballreference.com or some other online resource and newspaper archives, you piece those things together. But I didn't want to add 50 pages to the book just to get 50 box scores in there. And it occurred to me that I could keep the cost of the book down by keeping the pages down if I put the pictures and the box scores, and you mentioned the play-by-play, somewhere else. So the QR code does take you to the website. Each year, each chapter has some pictures and the box score, thanks to the great folks at baseballreference.com. And then a fan can do a deeper walk on their own down memory lane if that particular box score's got some name in it. Oh, gosh, I remember that player was my favorite player. You know, I'm sure you would love to delve into that 1999 Rays game, right?
Yes.
The Orioles and the Rays. I remember that game because Frank Howard, my childhood hero,
yeah,
the first base coach for the Rays. He just kept showing up on opening day. But, you know, those are the kind of things you find when you look in box scores or online newspaper articles and pictures that you just may not remember vividly, but boy, there they are. And it makes you feel very good about the days of the past when you love baseball so much.
Yeah, definitely. And we're so fortunate that it's a game that is so well recorded, you know, because I've had so many similar situations where the Frisco Rough Riders are the AA team up here, and you know, the manager is a guy named Brian Schaus. And I would have never known that except for I was going through one of the programs after we had been there for a game. And I was like, that guy used to be the bullpen coach for the Rays, or, you know, like, and just the way that the game is so interconnected and things like that. It's always fun to kind of go backwards and connect the dots. We're, of course, audio only. Listeners can't see your beautiful backdrop there. I'm looking at two jerseys. One is a red jersey, got the name Zimmerman on the back. And then, of course, we've got the home white Cal Ripken jersey kind of draped over a chair. Do you want to give us the significance of those two jerseys and why they're the ones that are up in your office?
Yeah, out of the 50 opening days I went to, I spent 33 of them with these two gentlemen. Cal Ripken Jr. in Baltimore was there every day for, I was at 31-61. I was at that game in August
of
96 when he broke the record with my 11-year-old son, kind of. And years later, I went to opening day with his son to see Ryan Zimmerman play. Ryan Zimmerman played the Nationals 14 of my opening days. And that's why those two gentlemen are so significant. They really harken to an era with the same guy, played for the same team their entire career, which you don't see too much anymore. So they're really tremendous stories. In the book, I tell the Cal Ripken story, many personal stories and encounters that our family had with Cal. I put that in chapter 1993 because the Ripken family was an important part of baseball in Baltimore. On that particular opening day, it was the first time Cal and his brother Billy were on opposite teams. They'd been teammates for many years. Billy got cut by the Orioles, let go by the Orioles during the previous offseason, signs with the Texas Rangers. And who were the opening day opponent in 93? The Texas Rangers. It was also painful for the Ripken family because it was the first time in Cal's career that his dad was not in the dugout, either as a coach or as a manager. And they'd offered him a demotion. He turned it down and was home watching the game on TV. So it was just a day that the family wanted to get out of the way and get over with. And so I just chose 93. You could put Cal Ripken's story in any one of 20 chapters, but that's where we put that one. And Zim, it was easy. He hits the walk-off home run in the ninth inning, and the night they christened Nationals Park in 08 to beat the Atlanta Braves, and he was dubbed Mr. Walk-Off that night. And he hit, in fact, every guy ahead of him on the list of walk-off home runs in his career is already in the Hall of Fame. Now, Ryan's not a Hall of Fame caliber player. We all get that. But in Washington, it was a no-brainer to retire his number. So that's why these guys are here. Big chunk of the story.
Yeah. I mean, you're right. There are not guys any longer who play for one team for their entire career. It just is non-existent now. And I mean, you see guys go from one team to their biggest rival, or you'll see, you know, the Edwin Jacksons of the world who basically play for 95% of all the teams. But you know, the Chipper Jones type.
Yeah, George Brett, Robin Yount, there's a few, but they stand out.
Yeah, right.
For that reason.
Yeah, exactly. You've obviously had a career that kind of revolved around sports and baseball. Can you kind of give listeners maybe the Cliff Notes version of how opening day kind of became your job?
Well, yeah, I never worked for a baseball team. I worked in sports television. I was at the bleeding edge of cable TV back in the early 80s and had, was in college. I went to Notre Dame, which was a sports school, and worked in the athletic department there. Got an internship with a PR firm that was focused in sports. Did that for a couple of years. I read chapter 1983 about a legendary Charlie Brotman. And then I get a job with a startup cable channel called Home Team Sports, which eventually became part of NBC Sports and more recently, Monumental Sports, and worked there for a couple of years. Left and went to the World Wrestling Federation for a couple of years and came back to home team sports. So I was in sports television for a few years, but then I left and went to work for Comcast Cable for the next 25 years. So no, I didn't work for ESPN and get a press pass all the time. I do pause in one chapter and say, I got a press pass for opening day. This is the greatest thing ever. And it was amazing. Ted Williams was there that day in Baltimore, and the President of the United States, and all these things. It was just a dream come true. I thank God every day. I lived a very privileged and blessed life to have so many really cool opportunities. I never took any of it for granted. Just kept finding ways to go to great baseball games, to go to the All-Star game in 76, to go. And by the way, I'm going to pause here. Your website did so much for me to force me to go back and research games I had attended at different stadiums, when they were. Is that stadium still here anymore? What are my memories of it? It was fantastic. So anyway, back to your point, I was able to go to different games, different places, doing some really cool stuff because of my connection to sports and television. But by no means was I a big shot in any of those fields.
No, but that's the dream, right? Is, you know, just to kind of be working even on the periphery of
yeah, close enough.
Yeah, baseball, true. That it's just like, oh, you know, I still sometimes just pinch myself recognizing what I've been afforded the opportunity to do and some of the lucky breaks that I've had and things like that. So I can imagine that, you know, 20 plus years of kind of doing something like that's got to be pretty special.
Well, and there were things on the bucket list, my bucket list, that never happened until the book came out. Mm. And that's when I like would find a mutual, like Frank Howard was my idol as a little boy. And he kept showing up on opening day. And I was there when they inducted him into the Ring of Honor at Nationals Park, but I never met him. Mm. I went to autograph day on my 9th birthday, but the line was too long to, you know, so I reached out to a friend and I said, it's time. I want to meet Frank Howard. And to be able to go to Frank Howard's house and spend an hour with him one-on-one at the ripe young age of 86 years old, this is just a year and a half ago.
Yeah.
And he, as we know, he passed away just a few months ago, was the thrill of a lifetime. And there's no notes, there's no book, there's no articles. It was just so incredibly special. I called his cell phone and left a message and figured that was going to be that. And about a week later, I get a phone call. You look down at your phone and it says, Frank Howard. Hmm. And your hand starts shaking. And you, hello? Hey, Mike, this is Frank Howard. How are you? Oh my gosh, I was 9 years old again. It was just fantastic. So that's the kind of things that we get to do just from the periphery, if you just jump on it and ask the right questions sometimes.
Yeah, I love that. What a great story. Unfortunate that was, you know, after the fact that the book came out, so it's not included, but what an incredible story. And, you know, you mentioned the Ripken story that's in the book, kind of chronicling the Ripken mm-hmm. family story. I flipped to, I can't remember what year it was, but, you know, one day the game, Dusty Baker got lost on his way to the ballpark, and I'm just like sitting there laughing to myself because you can totally see Dusty Baker doing that. But you know, that's one of the things I love about it so much is it's not just a cut and dry, here's what happened. It's not just your own memory wrapped up around that specific year or day. It's such a unique kind of weaving of all of that together that makes it really a lot more interesting than if it had been either one of those things on its own. But I know this is a tough question. Is there a favorite story in the book for you?
Yeah, there's two really emotionally hard stories. The tragic death of Harry Callis on opening day mm-hmm. In 2009, after he just called the World Series of the Phillies the year before, and that happened at Nationals Park. That was hard to tell. And researching it, I found the stadium announcer and I reached out to Jerome Hrushkin. I said, Jerome, recreate that day for me, for yourself. He said, you know, Mike, no one's ever asked me, but Harry Callis was like a father figure to me. I was the youngest stadium announcer in baseball. Every time the Phillies came in town, I idolized him. He would sit down with me for dinner. It was a really powerful story. Turns out he was the one who found Harry on the ground in the broadcast booth. And he performed chest compression before the paramedics got there. Of course, tragic ending. Less than an hour later, poor Jerome is told he's got to announce to 45,000 people what has happened to his idol, his father figure.
Yeah.
Those kind of chapters in the book, you can't, the tragic murder of my friend John McNamara is in there. It's one of the victims of the Annapolis Gazette shooting. So those were hard. But the one chapter that sticks out, they have to, is when baseball comes back to Washington. And when you wait for 33 plus years for that to happen, and your childhood dream comes true and it's finally back. And the emotions, I did the audio book myself. And when we tried to record that chapter, I broke down crying multiple times. I just kept, let's do it again. So hard. And I have now, I don't know when you last checked the site, but about 2 weeks ago, we finally said, you know, it's been 2 years. Let's put the audio book up on the website so people can listen to it a chapter at a time if they want. As you said earlier, jump around. But as you listen to chapter 2005, you probably hear my voice crack a couple of times because it was something unbelievably special.
Talk to us a little bit about what that meant to, I mean, it's obviously a big deal to the metro of D.C., but you, as someone who grew up a fan of the Senators, and then obviously a big enough fan of the game to try to kind of fill the void through some surrogate teams that you kind of latched on to, but when you hear the news that there's going to be baseball back in D.C., one, did you believe it, and two, you know, then what?
Yeah, I believed it. And there have been so many efforts over the years that were false alarms. You know, in the early, in 74 or so, the San Diego Padres were supposedly coming to Washington. And there were rumors of other teams. But what was really happening was baseball was using Washington to get a new stadium for the city or an expansion fee from that city. But by the time it came down to the Expos, yeah, I believed it. We got the news in late September of the prior year. And a couple moments there where you pause and think of that poor little boy in Montreal who's losing his team, and you can relate. Getting to the game, I wrote a letter to the Washington Post when I heard the news, and I kind of reminisced about what it was like to be at the last ugly Senators game in September of 1971, and all hell broke loose, and the fans were throwing things on the field. They stormed the field. The Senators wound up losing the game by forfeit to the Yankees. That's the last memory you have, really? So to bridge that gap and retell that story with those details, the Nationals did a wonderful, Major League Baseball owned the Nationals at that time in 05, did a wonderful job recreating a very perfect pregame ceremony that brought back a dozen or so one-time Washington Senators, introducing them one by one onto the field, and they some of them weren't getting around so well as I used to, but Mickey Vernon and Eddie Brinkman and Joe Rosenda and Dick Bosman, it was on and on. And they saved Frank Howard for last. And the stadium shook and I'm sobbing and adults were crying everywhere. It was really a big, powerful, emotional night for the city. And most people there, very few of us, I think, were at the last Senators game and the first Nationals game, just because of the passage of years and in life. But it was, I don't know that you could ever replicate that. There's no city that I know of that has that long a gap. A lot of cities lost NFL teams. Various baseball teams have moved. I can feel for the people of Oakland right now that are going through the same thing, because they certainly have plenty of World Series championships in the past to look back on and great teams. We didn't have that in Washington, at least not in my life, but very emotional life.
Man, I can only imagine. I mean, you know, as a fan of the Rays, no longer living in that area, I obviously am a little more disconnected probably than the folks who live there. But you hear the rumors of the team, you know, being sold, being moved, doing split season between Montreal and Tampa Bay, and it gets you. It really does. And so to think about, like you said, the people in Oakland, what they're going through now, that for some of them, that's been all they've known their entire life. And now it's going to be gone. to kind of put yourself in the shoes of, you know, you as a kid losing the Senators and then that 35-year stretch and just thinking, holy smokes, they're coming back.
It's got to be pretty special.
Yeah, for sure. So was that the favorite baseball memory, or is there something that tops even getting your team back?
Favorite baseball memory at this point, looking back, it's got to be the Nationals winning the World Series.
2019.
Now my 50th opening day was opening day 2019. You can't let the book end there. So I'm writing it during the pandemic and had to add an epilogue. And it's life's lessons according to Davey. Davey Martinez had three things he told his team a lot. Stay in the fight, go 1-0, and bumpy roads lead to beautiful places. And by golly, the bumpy road the Nationals went on in 19 to win the World Series was the beautiful place. And I mentioned earlier, a lot of cool things happened because of the book. I went to a fundraiser for the DC Grays Urban Baseball Program in Washington in May after the book came out. And I brought copies of the book to give to a couple of radio guys that had me on the week prior, just as a courtesy, say, here's the books. I brought the books, then I hid them in the corner, and one of them walked in. I said, just a minute, I got a book for you. And I went over to get the books where I had hidden them in the corner. And there's two guys sitting at a table and an open seat where my books are. And I asked the gentleman, excuse me, I got to get the books. And as I'm doing that, I realized, oh my goodness, this is Mike Rizzo and Dave Martinez, the general manager and manager of the Washington Nationals from the previous season. I quickly said, you know those two books? They're not going to the radio guys. So I asked Davey and Mike if the seat was taken. They said, no, go ahead. So I sat there and had cigars and wine and talked baseball and signed the book to Dave Martinez. Thanks for the epilogue. Because that final chapter, that final piece was absolutely my finest baseball memory. Just for a team that started out 1931, come back and win the World Series. Never been done before. Will probably never happen again.
What a perfect ending to the story.
Amen.
You know,
that's right.
I mean, not only what the Nationals did, not only winning the World Series, but then for you to just, you know, casually happen across these two guys sitting there. And I mean, wow. I mean, that's.
And Davey was going to the Caps playoff game that night in this particular place where it was a couple of blocks away. And I pounced.
Yeah.
Great.
I'm glad you had the guts to do it, because a lot of people would have maybe shied away and maybe, you know, hearkening back to you picking up the Frank Howard phone calls just to have your voice jump a couple octaves. And yeah, but I'm glad you did it. I mean, like, that's incredible. And it probably meant the world to him to know that, you know, here you are with 50 years of stories, and it wraps up with the Nats winning a World Series thanks to him and finishing the fight. I remember the slogan all throughout the postseason. And
they're such valuable lessons for life. I don't care whether you're talking baseball or anything else. Go 1-0. Just go out there and do what you can today to be successful.
Yeah.
Worry about tomorrow. Stay in the fight. Don't quit. Right. And there's going to be bumpy roads. But if you stay on that bumpy road, you go 1-0, stay in the fight, it'll lead to a beautiful place.
That's what's so great about this game is,
amen.
You know, that's it. It's just a parallel to life. And it's just such a good allegory for our day to day and our life to life. And 50 years wrapped up in one book is pretty special, and plenty of life lessons there.
My best friend for 45 of those 50 years, Steve Ebner, was dying of cancer as the book was getting ready to come out. And he's in a lot of the latter chapters. Mm-hmm. Like, I tore up my knee. He's the one that got me to the game in a wheelchair. He was there with me multiple times, earned training companion. And so the book is written. I'm doing the audio book recordings. I just need his permission, because now it's time to, you know, the acknowledgments you put in the front of the book. I said, and for people like Steve Ebner that are dealing with these struggles, you know, may his bumpy road lead to a beautiful place. And it really, I said, can I put this in the book, Steve? He said, that's good. I like that. Another fitting finish to the very last words that got done before I went to press was a tribute to Steve. So all, you know, a lot of people talk about the stadium was this or the team was that or the favorite player. It's so often it's who you were with at the game that makes the memory so special.
That's 100% right. And that is I think, why we love the game so much. And maybe we don't even necessarily recognize that when we're younger, and we can't understand why we want to be at the ballpark or on the couch watching the game with somebody, but we do. And, turns out it's a lot less about the baseball and a lot more about who you're sitting next to. And that's 100% right. So what a beautiful thing. It really is. What's left? I mean, come on. What is left? You've seen 50 opening days. I mean, you met Frank Howard face to face. Is there still something at the top of the list? You saw your team win a World Series. I mean, what more?
Your sight in it pushed me to come to grips with what's left. There is one thing that's within my control.
Right.
I do want to go to the Field of Dreams game in Iowa. I love the fact that this year it's in Alabama, a tribute to the Negro League, et cetera. That's fantastic. But that movie and all the subsequent documentaries that have been done on the making of and so forth are so telling about how people in Hollywood were tripping over themselves to be associated with this movie and the weather challenges they faced with the cornfield and all these great things about the game of baseball. And the acknowledgement, the dedication in the front of the book is dedicated to baseball fans everywhere. That's about, and I go on to quote Jane Joel Jones from the book. That's really tells you about the game of baseball and what it's done for all of us and how it's, what's the point of that movie? It's reconnecting with his dad through this field outside a farm. That's part of what makes the game great. And that is a place I want to go, and I want to be part of that game. That's the only one thing in baseball that's left on my list.
It's a good choice. I've not been. I would also love to go. I'm afraid I would just cry the whole time, though. You know what I mean? Like, I'm afraid I wouldn't be able to enjoy it because I wouldn't be able to see anything through the tears and the sobbing.
And I already know who I'm going with. Another great side story is how the book has brought people into my life that I didn't know before. I didn't know what Sabre was either. I used Sabre.org site to do some research for the book, but I did not realize it was a organization that brought together the geekiest baseball fans in the world.
Right.
God bless them all. Love them. Got to know many of them. But I get hit up via my website after the book comes out from a guy. I thought I was getting an email from myself. It was a guy in San Diego named Michael Orton. Ken Rosenthal had tweeted about the book. This guy's friends hit him up, say, "Hey, Mike, we didn't know you wrote a book," but turns out he's every bit the baseball junkie I am. So I wound up later going out to L.A. to visit our daughter, and then I drove down to San Diego to go to a Padres game at Petco Field with Michael Ortman. We have become baseball besties in the 2 years since. And when I started reading about this year's Field of Dreams game, populating your site with that information on my bucket list, I said, when that game comes back to Iowa, do you want to go with me? And it was the fastest response to a text I ever got. Absolutely. It's almost like, I don't care what it costs, got to do it. And I know it's, a few dozen of your followers have singled that out as something they want to do too, but that'll be a very special cherry on the sundae.
I think so. That's a good one. I think it's done the right way usually. Judging from the firsthand accounts I've heard of folks who have been there and what I've seen on TV. So I think it's got to be kind of baseball at its best. So what a fitting answer.
Yeah. I've been to Cooperstown. I've won a World Series, been to All-Star games, opening days. That's the only other one I got.
Yeah, I like it. I guess I have one more question for you, and that is, does the streak continue? Is opening day still a thing for you?
Absolutely. I figure if I'm going to get to 50 more, I'm either going to have to live to 116 or I'm going to do two or three a year. After the lockout ended, I did go to three opening days that year. I went to Philadelphia for the first time. Went to Baltimore and went to Washington. Last year, I went to Baltimore and Washington. This year, now I'm living in Florida. I'm still flying up to Washington for opening day. So I'll get a couple in. So yeah, it continues. It's a ritual. I'm just going to keep going and going like the Energizer Bunny. On that opening day in Philadelphia, I see this little crowd gathering around the Harry Callis statue in center field. I'm a little curious, like, what's that all about? And I asked one of the Phillies officials, what's this all about? Well, Harry's son sings the national anthem here every year on opening day. Oh, my. So he's an opera star. It was fabulous.
Wow.
And after he's done, I go up and introduce myself. And I said, 13 years after the fact, I want to express my condolences, but I was at Nats Park the day your dad died. And we had a wonderful conversation. He wanted the book. Of course, he wanted to read what I had to say about his dad. But those kind of things just keep coming up. And that's how you extend your opening day streak to other cities. And sometimes these rich rewards come as a result of it. Same day in Philadelphia, I run into Greg Luzinski, who's got his barbecue place there. And he's signing things. I was at Greg Luzinski's first game with the White Sox. He hits a home run on opening day in 1981 when he was playing in Chicago. So he was more than happy for the picture in the book and those kind of things. Just so we're going to find new ways to get to opening days in different places, but I'm excited about it.
Yeah, I love it. I love the idea of kind of expanding, you know, beyond Washington and seeing some different places. It's kind of cool opening the door to unique things like that. And there's always going to be kind of like the 6 degrees of Kevin Bacon. There's always going to be something that ties back to a game that you were at once before. So, Michael, I've so enjoyed this. I really have. I love the book. I think it's such a unique idea. It really just kind of ties all the things I love about the game together. Where do we send people to find you online?
Openingday5050.com. There you can listen to each chapter. We just uploaded the audio files recently. You can order the book itself, either Kindle or Amazon, whatever you want to get. But also, as you mentioned earlier, the pictures that bring to life and add credibility and credence to all these stories. Like, no, that didn't really happen. Well, yeah, actually, here's a picture. Are there and is the box score and the play-by-play and a lot of fun stuff there. So, and then a lot of the interviews and things that we've done too, to reviews, a lot of good things there. So openingday5050.com.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much for joining us. I really enjoyed it and, you know, look forward to hearing about opening day 2024 and seeing what that holds in store.
And Anna, thank you and all you do for the game and us fans. We appreciate it.
And that will wrap up this episode of the Baseball Bucket List podcast. Special thanks to Michael Ortman for joining us today and sharing those 50 years of baseball stories and memories. If this sounds like something you'd like to do, if you think you might like to be a guest on the show, head to baseballbucketlist.com/podcast and fill out an application. I'd absolutely love to hear from you. While you're there, make sure to spend some time on the site, sign up for a free membership, build your own baseball bucket list, and track your ballpark visits. If you find yourself enjoying the show each week, please take a moment to rate and review it in the podcast app of your choice. I would really appreciate it, and it goes such a long way. That's it for this week. Thanks so much for listening. We'll see you next episode. This podcast is part of the Curved Brim Media Network. Here are some of the other members of Curved Brim Media.
Hi, this is Kelly Robinson, the minor league nerd. My YouTube channel explores the history of minor league baseball teams. More than just stats, we delve into team lineage, sharing stories from current franchises to obscure one-year wonders.
Hey guys, this is Patrick Larson from the Minor League Baseball Hat History Series. And in every episode, I go through the history of minor league teams through my personal collection of hats. You can find me on Twitter at @PatLarson1. I hope you guys enjoy.
This is Patrick.
And Corey.
Of BaseballMapper.com. And we have made an interactive map to help highlight all baseball teams from the majors down to collegiate summer leagues.
We want to bring you closer to baseball, so get on the site and find a team near you today.
Hi, this is Ed Rivera of the Data Chronicles. Join me as I interview people just like you and players, coaches, GMs on the path that led you to become a fan of the sport.
Hey everyone, it's Eric from the great state of Kansas.
This is Johnny from the New Orleans Baby Cakes Memorial Museum.
And we are the Earn Fun Average Podcast,
where we talk to a variety of guests about their love of baseball and have fun doing it.
America, lower your standards.
Average is what we do best.
I'm Paul Caputo, and on the Baseball by Design podcast, I talk to minor league baseball teams, designers, and other super interesting people about what these minor league baseball logos mean. And I talk a little bit about ice cream helmets.
Learn more about Curved Brim Media at curvedbrimmedia.com.